You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Ryan Crotty. Ryan, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hi, Brainerd. Thanks for having me.
Ryan, we're talking about your show, of course, at High Noon, Manual Transmission. And I'm excited to talk about this because it seems that there's a number of things happening here. To dive into the process first, I want to talk about some themes and potentially narratives here, but let's talk about your process, because you're working on linen, but you're using a kind of modeling paste and gel that almost looks like resin, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I use the modeling paste as the ground, and I'm applying multiple layers of that and wet sanding in between to kind of get a lustrous satin surface. And I feel like that really sets up the painting to reflect light through the layers later on. And then the gloss gel medium is tinted with like a high pigmented transparent acrylic, and just using three colors on all these works: Hansa yellow light, a quinacridone red, and a phthalo blue. And they're all transparent shades. So I tint the gloss gel medium and typically apply one layer at a time. So it's covering the whole surface with the yellow, and then carving into that surface and then letting it dry, and then repeating the process with the red and the blue. And in the paint, that gloss gel medium is opaque when it's applied. And so you don't totally know if you've nailed like the, you know, the thickness or the intensity of certain parts of the painting. So it is a little bit of intuition and experience, you know, at play there as far as applying the layers.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So it's almost like printmaking. I mean, there's surprises in here that happens.
Yeah, very much so. It's definitely rooted in printmaking for sure.
So let's talk about the theme of this show, and then we'll get back to some of these specific works. Manual transmission. This is specifically from Timothy Barker, right? Against Transmission. And I don't know that book or that philosophy, but that's in part what's happening here in the works as you describe them, right?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, you know, manual, it's a great word, you know, that describes kind of the partnership between man and machine as far as a stick shift, you know, in a vehicle. But, you know, breaking those words apart, you've got manual, which is referencing craft and labor. And then you've got transmission to, like I was saying, you've got the optical play of light moving through these translucent layers, hitting that rear ground of the modeling paste and reflecting back to our eyes. And so that color mixing is happening in real time, that transmission of light to our eyes, you know, is kind of a magical thing. So those two together, I think, made for a great kind of catchy and familiar term, but also really described the work well.
And so let's talk about, how that does describe the work, because that's a really interesting kind of process, but it's also speaking to a kind of narrative here, right? We're talking about a lineage of color field painting, which it, in many ways defies talking about. It's almost a kind of paranormal experience, for instead of saying spiritual, right, but something a little out of this world. How do you see that? And again, I'm kind of talking about the narrative of these abstract works or the viewer experience in what we're discussing, manual transmission.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the color fields are not, you know, autobiographical. So they, you know, the tonal shifts happening there leave it really open to experience. So, I would almost say that there isn't a specific narrative that's going on, but I definitely have found, you know, from the beginning, from the early works that I was making, that the color field is kind of an important part of the overall composition and experience of the works. You're getting this kind of depth and reflection of light. Not just the reflection of light, but also whatever else is behind the, you know, the picture plane in the gallery. So there's a whole lot that's being captured in that color field, but really that, you know, that perception and experience of the viewer is what's, I think, paramount there.
And to talk about the perception or the experience of the viewer, how are you thinking about that? I mean, like, again, in the lineage of color field painting, there was a lot of discussion on that, right, in terms of what the viewer is experiencing. Is it entirely subjective? Is it, you know, something else that's being reached for?
I would say it's almost entirely subjective. Yeah. I think that when you're standing in front of it, that experience of looking almost into a void or kind of an endless depth. I mean, you're touching on the sublime a little bit, touching on kind of this experience of depth that is created, you know, by the glossiness of the paint, but also the, you know, the tonal shifts in the colors that are layered on top of each other. So there is, I think, this experience standing in front of them that is much different than that of experiencing them on a screen. When I'm photographing them, I'm using like a black drop cloth in the background to remove the reflections so that it's clear, you know, what the surface looks like. And then when you're in person, you're seeing yourself reflected and a background reflected, lights in the gallery reflected in the surface. So it adds this kind of almost inner world or additional depth to the, you know, to the centers of the painting. Usually I reserve the color field for the center of the composition. But yeah, I think it's very subjective, and I think I mean, you know, it's different than Rothko's color fields. You know, in this case, inevitably you become kind of a player in the color field as you're reflected standing in front of it. So there is a difference there, but yeah, I would say it's almost entirely subjective at that point.
And let's talk about some of the individual works. So to begin with, yeah, that's so interesting also how they're photographed, right? And that is a different experience from standing in front of it, because you stand in front of it and right, you see yourself, you're part of the image. That's a different experience than what people see online, right? I mean, I've seen the show, but for those who don't get to see the show, you're looking at images online, then there's another experience when they're in front of you, which is, I would think, I mean, it is, since I've seen it, much more luminous, right? When we're in front of these are kind of glowing, or that's how they felt to me. Whereas when we're looking at images online, it's a very different experience of it, right?
Yes, for sure. Yeah, they are very luminous, and I think, again, that's the translucency and the light play that's happening. There was a comment one time, an online comment on social media, you know, asking if they were backlit, if the paintings were backlit. And, you know, of course they're not. There's numerous layers. There's nothing behind, but they do have this kind of luminosity that tends to just glow when they're lit well. I almost think of it as they drink up or consume the light. Like, they are very light hungry paintings, but they certainly respond when they're lit well.
So let's talk about some individual work. Sub Rosa, I like that name. This also feels different than some of the rest. It has a sense of a of a doorway and an arch. Can I ask what's happening here? Is that fair to ask? You know, and it feels almost theatrical to me. Again, this is my subjective experience. I'm reading things into it, but it feels like sort of portals within portals, and it's kind of bringing me in. I feel like I keep going further into it. But again, that's my subjective experience. Perhaps the name Sub Rosa also has something to do with your narrative or experience.
Yeah, I mean, no, I like that reading of it. So a lot of these paintings, and even the very early paintings when I was developing this process, really kind of activated the outside edges of the picture plane. And so this one does as well, although it's pushed back a little bit. And then there's the introduction of that kind of archway over the top. I have always felt like the paintings were portals or voids or passageways, so to speak. And this feels like that as well, but maybe and part of it is just how the direction of the gestures being made that kind of created that slit down the middle and gives it almost a veil or a curtain feel. But I did like that was activating the interior of that, what would be normally just a color field space. It activates it a little bit more, and it almost takes those outside edges, collapses it down to the center, and then it exists inside that arch, and it does have that feeling then of multiple portals or entrances. And since it did have this kind of feeling of a curtain or a veil, that's where the title came from, Sub Rosa, something, behind that being masked off or being hidden in behind that curtain or veil. I liked the idea of that there could be something lurking behind.
I like that. So that is quite a kind of story to that, surprisingly. And I like what you're saying also about things happening at the edges. That was to speak about exit strategy, which I'd like to talk about next. There was my first experience with color field type work was an Albers painting, and it was homage to the square, and I remember that feeling so well. It was actually my mother who was saying something to me because I was kind of like, what's happening here? I think I was like 16 or something. And she said, look at the edges. What's happening at the edges? And, yeah, things were glowing at the edges. There were perceptual things happening that were really kind of neurological or something, right? And it seems, in a remote way, to relate to that work or perhaps what you're talking about in the things happening at the edges. Yeah, let's talk about Get a Move On is the one I was thinking of in terms of edges. It feels like you're looking into a mirror almost, of course, but it looks different online.
That one, and that one was interesting too. So a lot of times to make these gestures, I built kind of a rig of linear rails that sits above the painting, and they operate on an XY axis. And it just kind of helps me to make a more straight line over a distance. It's still pulled by hand. And in this case, usually I rehearse the gestures that I'm going to make in each layer to expose the colors of the layer below. And in this case, for Get a Move On, I really wanted to not have too much of a set plan. Even if I have rehearsed it and it's a set plan, the paint doesn't always behave like I expect, and a lot of times there are adjustments on the fly. But this one in particular was kind of a more free form decision making, like in the moment. There's approximately 20 minutes while the paint, this very thin layer of paint, is wet, and then I can make marks into it before it starts to dry and set up. So this one was very kind of reacting compositionally, like on the fly. And I think it has that kind of looseness around the outside. I mean, there's still vertical and horizontal lines, but there are some twists and turns, and there are some beautiful things happening within the edges of the paint being pushed in and manipulated there.
Right, the twists and turns, some of the beautiful things happening is we're getting a kind of dimensionality, right? There's a kind of depth there that looks almost like ribbons moving around. Is that in part what you mean?
Yes, exactly. You can see on the top right and the bottom left how it shifts a little bit. It's not just a straight line across. And I like that you mentioned ribbons there. I think of the marks as light tubes or ribbons of paint. That's exactly how I think about it. And there is kind of a nice contrast that happens too as you're moving that material across the surface, while the tool dipped into the paint and being pulled across the surface is making like a straight line essentially. It is pushing paint out to either side, and so you're getting this kind of contrast too that's happening of, a very vertical straight line, and then kind of the organic nature of this ribbon of paint being pushed out away from that line as the material is accumulating on the surface.
And so exit strategy, let's talk about that. I love that title too, and in a way this one seems somewhat straightforward since, as a viewer I tend to kind of imagine what's happening here, but this one feels more like a window. It feels, given that title, I feel like jumping through it or something, or it feels part of that. But exit strategy, of course, has a number of meanings. Can you tell me about this in terms of that title?
Yeah, it does have several different meanings, some maybe a little bit darker. But specifically in thinking about this title, as I was saying, the paint accumulates as I'm pulling it across the surface, and it builds up quite rapidly, even though they're very thin layers. And so I found that I needed an exit strategy to literally move the paint off of the surface. So otherwise I'd have these large lumps of paint that would kind of conflict with the composition that I'm going for. So exit strategy became quite literal in my mind as far as needing a place to move the paint off of the edge of the canvas. And you can see that in the bottom left and bottom right of that painting, in the composition of that painting. I'm moving the paint all the way off the edge, and creating quite a mess in the studio at that point too. But yeah, it feels. Sure.
What is causing the mess in the studio at that point? And I want you to continue with what you were saying as well, but.
Oh yeah. So on this aperture that hangs down over the painting, I've just kind of cobbled together this spring-loaded system where I can interchange different shaped tools, typically made of plexiglass or like the rubber from a squeegee, a printmaking squeegee, and so I create these little shapes that I can clip on to the bottom of this aperture, and has a spring-loaded arm on it so that it will press down against the linen. And gravity is at play because these are all made laying flat. So it will kind of hit the surface naturally because of the spring-loaded hinge that it's on. So as it's pulling across the surface, the paint builds up. And when it gets to that edge, if I'm not in the right place or haven't set up kind of a catch system, it will flip paint across the studio. That happens quite regularly in those moments. It's built up on the piece of plexi or the piece of squeegee that I'm using as the tool, and then it will kind of come off the edge and fling the paint across the studio onto me or onto the floor. It's
I
great.
love that. That's a great image, sort of like a
Yeah.
painting, like fighting back or something. That's quite an action coming from a painting, really, right?
It is, yeah. It's great.
So was there something you were about to say before when I interrupted and asked you? We were we're talking about exit strategy. I just didn't want to lose that thought if you were about to say something that you remembered.
I think only compositionally, when I was, again, first making these paintings years ago, I was practicing on just some cheaper student canvases, and you have kind of a crossbar in the middle. And I was applying paint over the entire surface and then reducing it down with a sheet of plexiglass smoothed on one edge. And the plexi bends, and so it can kind of conform to the sag in the canvas or the pressure that you're putting on it as you're moving across the surface. But that center stretcher bar in the back of those canvases, you know, you would strike that as you're going over the surface. And so it would create this kind of center line and break the composition into these two parts, you know, the upper rectangle and the lower rectangle. And I always kind of felt like that referenced some of Rothko's color fields as well. But yeah, it's maybe a gesture back to those early works made on those, you know, inexpensive canvases. And you know, just the actual nature of the composition that came from that, from the act of applying the paint.
I'm so glad you mentioned that too. You know, the references and that and those early works that makes so much sense, and that's really clear. I want to ask you one more question before you go. It's been great talking to you about all this, and hopefully listeners can see this before it closes on the 20th in a few days. But if not, of course, there's links here to learn more about what we're talking about. What are you reading at the moment?
Well, reading a couple books, kind of junk. Back and forth from different books or podcasts while I'm in the studio. The one I'm currently queued up is The Wise Man's Fear by Patrick Rothfuss. It's in the King Killer Chronicles. It's kind of fantasy, but it's incredible storytelling and it's very entertaining. So when I am wet sanding modeling paste for hours on end, that's great to listen to. And then also listening to Mastery by Robert Greene, and that covers lots of different leaders in their fields and how they overcame different aspects of their lives to find mastery in whatever their skill or talent was. And then I'm still making my way through Art is Life by Jerry Saltz as well. It's both entertaining and an interesting peek into the art world.
Well, thanks so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time and your work. And again, there's more links here for listeners to learn more. Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure, Ryan.
Thanks, Brainerd, and I would say the same. Take care.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.